CFM 93.2 is a charity and works with the diverse communities in Bristol. So please continue to support us by getting involved and spreading the word.
Welcome back to BCFM's Politics Show, Friday Drive Time, with Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. A political purge in China, but who's won? And what will it mean for the world's second superpower? Also, the cat's out of the bag. A final stage of privatisation of Royal Mail means the post will be between 30 to 40% more expensive. Kevin Beazer is here to tell us how the communication workers still trying to stop Royal Mail being sold. Plus, George Osborne says the Green Investment Bank is on its way. But what is the Green Investment Bank? What will it invest in? And what will it all mean? But first, British ex-servicemen have launched a national campaign called Veterans for Peace this week over the Easter holiday. And I'm joined now on the line by a former SAS soldier, Ben Griffin. Hi, Ben. Welcome to Drive Time.
Hello, Tony, and thanks for having us.
Can you tell us then, first of all, why did you start this campaign?
Yeah, well, actually, it's an organisation. It started over 25 years ago in the United States. A group of veterans got together. I think they were mostly Vietnam veterans. And as a result of their experiences, they decided that war wasn't the answer and decided to start a veterans group called Veterans for Peace, who campaigned for world peace. I myself left the army in 2005 after serving in Iraq. And I've been looking to start up some sort of veterans organisation where the soldiers who had decided to renounce violence and campaign for peace, and I met one of these guys from America, and he gave me the idea to start up a UK chapter, and that's what we launched on Monday.
But how can soldiers actually fight for peace? How can a soldier be a pacifist, Ben?
Well, we're not fighting for peace, and we're not actually a pacifist organisation. We're committed to resisting war through non-violent means, but not all of our members are pacifists. You know, some of our members believe that it is okay to defend your country with force. However, there are many pacifists within our organisation.
Can you just tell us, I don't know if you're allowed to, but can you tell us what you were doing when you were a soldier?
Yeah, sure. I mean, I served for 8 years in a parachute regiment in the SAS. I served in Northern Ireland, Yugoslavia, Afghanistan and Iraq. And it was when I served in Iraq with the Special Air Service that I decided that I couldn't serve in Iraq anymore, and I couldn't serve in the army anymore. If I had to listen to my conscience, which was telling me that this was the wrong thing to do. As a result of that, I was discharged from the army. After I left the army, I started to speak out about what was happening in Iraq. I still do think that I've got a duty to tell people back home the reality of war, you know, the dirty side of war, not what you see on the Help for Heroes campaigns or in the Call of Duty video games. And as a result of that, I was taken to the High Court and given a lifetime injunction in a secret trial, which prevents me from talking about anything I know as a result of my service in Iraq. So that's my own story. That's where I'm coming from. And a lot of the guys who are in the organisation have got different stories. We've got guys from World War II, a D-Day veteran. We've got guys who served in Malaya, Northern Ireland, Aden, we've got guys who served in the Falklands, and right up to now we've got some veterans of Iraq and Afghanistan.
Well, I would like to just point out that for anyone that's interested in what you were injuncted that you weren't allowed to say, you were filmed, weren't you, before the injunction was served, so you were able to say it on that film. And so if people want to go and find you on YouTube online, they can hear exactly what you were told that you weren't allowed to say. The UK's all-party parliamentary group, Ben, on rendition, has just been refused access to key documents in the US this week. This is under the so-called Freedom of Information Act, and the US government is actually now saying that because Britain is a foreign power, that British parliamentarians are not allowed to use the Freedom of Information Act.
Well, I mean, it seems that we're a foreign power when it suits the Americans, and we're there, you know, the special relationship when it suits them. I mean, I suppose the bare fact is that the British entered into a coalition with the Americans in both Iraq and Afghanistan. once you're a coalition partner with someone, what the other coalition partner does, you are also legally responsible for. So this calling us a foreign power, you know, to me, I mean, that's a bit of a red herring. We're in coalition with the Americans in Iraq. We're in coalition with the Americans in Afghanistan. And so what they do and what we do, the other party is also culpable for.
Okay, Ben, can you tell us about some of the other people, the other individuals who are involved in Veterans for Peace then?
Yeah, sure. We've got some really interesting characters. We've got a guy called Jim Radford, who was a very young lad. He was 15 when he was over at D-Day in the Merchant Navy, serving on the tugboat recovery service. They were pulling the landing craft off the beaches to help create space for more landing craft to hit the beaches. He later joined the Royal Navy when he was older. And Jim's been a prominent peace campaigner since the 1950s, involved in the ex-services CND branch. And Jim's also a great folk singer, actually. He's sung some brilliant anti-war songs that I launched on Monday. And then bringing it a bit more up to date, we've got a guy called Michael Lyons. He was a Navy medic. He was serving on submarines. He was told he was going to deploy to Afghanistan and thought he'd better educate himself about that conflict before he went over there. And he started to read the WikiLeaks Afghan war diaries, and he watched a collateral murder video that was from Iraq, and decided that actually he didn't want to be a part of it. He didn't want to go to Afghanistan and help to torture people and help to kill innocent civilians out there. And he applied for conscientious objector status. That was turned down. He was told to deploy to Afghanistan. He refused to carry out rifle training, and as a result of that, he served 7 months in Colchester prison. Veterans for Peace, last year we were active in campaigning for Michael and also supporting him through his time in prison. We held vigils outside of the prison and also went to visit him. And I'm glad to say that Michael joined Veterans for Peace after he left the Navy.
Okay, so what about the general feeling? I think this is something that we may not be aware of amongst serving soldiers, Ben, about the wars in places like Afghanistan. I mean, obviously, you've got to, you know, if you're in the army, you've got to simply go and do what you're told. But what are the feelings once you're back in the barracks afterwards?
Well, I mean, it's a bit of a myth, really, saying that you've got to do as you're told. Under international law, I think it's the Geneva Conventions and the Hague Convention, soldiers are duty bound actually to refuse illegal orders. So so when people say, oh, you're a soldier, you signed up, you've got to do as you're told, that's not actually the case. You know, your actual obligations under international law still stand. But you know, there's a wide range of opinion within the military. You only need to go onto the Army Rumour Service website, I think it's called ARS, and you'll see many opinions from serving soldiers. You know, there are guys, of course, who completely agree with the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, and they think that they're doing the right thing. And then there are guys who think that actually the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan are a waste of time, but they're in the army and they're soldiers and they can't, you know, can't see themselves doing anything else, so they'll continue to serve in those wars. What I found in my own experience is that after guys have left, after there's been a bit of time between their service, say 5 to 10 years afterwards, they start to make a reassessment about what they're involved in. I know many Falklands veterans now, actually, who don't understand why we went back down there. And, you know, I know there's a lot of jingoism around at the minute, 30 years, the Falklands and all the rest of it, but I know plenty of guys who fought down there with Tupara who definitely don't think it was worth their time. So I think as time goes by, soldiers are more likely to take a sort of harder look at what they were involved in and decide, you know, maybe that wasn't such a good thing after all.
And what about amongst the, you know, the sort of officer class, the upper class in the army? Do they also have doubts about some of these conflicts?
Yeah, I mean, you can check it out on YouTube, actually. He's in the American army, but there's no great difference between the Americans and the British. Like I said, we're in coalition. There's a lieutenant colonel who's just come out, still serving, and he's telling the American people that the war in Afghanistan is a lie. You know, you can check him out, actually, on the Democracy Now! Website. So there's definitely within the military, within the officer class, you know, a realisation. Of course there is. They know it's a lie. You know, they know that we can't win in Afghanistan. They know that we're going to end up making a deal with the Taliban. And they know that the guys who are dying and being injured right now are dying for a lost cause.
What's Veterans for Peace's experience of dealing with the press? And what are your thoughts on the press in general?
I mean, you know, certain press organisations won't run our stories or aren't so interested, but you know, we've had some good experiences with the press as well. I mean, the press is what it is. You know, it jumps from one story to the next, drops a story. You know, 1 minute, you know, the amount of people who are being killed in Afghanistan is a big story, and the next minute you don't hear a thing about Afghanistan. So, you know, that's the nature of the beast. The media moves from one story to the next, and, you know, I suppose you've just got to ride it while it's on the story that you're talking about.
Okay. Also, I wonder if you think that there is, you're part of a general changing sentiment, because generally speaking, you know, we hear one or two blips of individuals like yourself a few years ago who are speaking out, but now you're actually a bit organised, a bit more organised. Do you think this is indicative of a bigger change?
I'm not sure about that. I think that there's a great history in this country of veterans organising. You know, the ex-services CND branch was running for many years, which was full of guys who had served in the Second World War and in national service, who were really appalled at what nuclear weapons could do and decided to organise, and they took part in some great actions. Like I said before, you know, it's been going in America for over 25 years, Veterans for Peace. So, in effect, it's one of the messages I'm trying to get across to veterans, that this isn't a new thing in a certain sense, and that they shouldn't be worried or scared about getting involved if that's what they think they should do.
Okay, finally, Ben, where do we find you online and out there, on the street, so to speak?
Yeah, sure. I mean, you can find our website. It's veteransforpeace.org.uk, and we regularly update that. And also, we've been campaigning. One of our campaigns at the minute is for Bradley Manning, who's been in jail now for 18 months and still awaiting trial. He's the guy who's accused of leaking the WikiLeaks information to Julian Assange. We've been campaigning around him, trying to get the charges dropped and him released from prison. And we've been holding vigils outside of the embassy, the US embassy in London, when he's been in court in America. And actually this week we're up in West Wales, a couple of us are up in West Wales. There's a play out now called The Radicalisation of Bradley Manning. That's going to be live streamed on the National Theatre Wales website this weekend. It's a brilliant play by a guy called Tim Price, and it really tells us the story of Bradley Manning, you know, this guy who actually went to school in Wales, who's now in this military prison out in America, facing life imprisonment.
Okay, Ben Griffin, former SAS Parachute Regiment and from Veterans for Peace, thanks very much for joining us on Drive Time.
Thanks a lot, Tony. Thanks.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
And we're from one fight to another, and I'm joined in the studio now by Kevin Beezer, who's from the Communication Workers Union. Hi, Kevin. Welcome to Drive Time. Now, one of the things which has happened over the last few weeks is we've been told that there's going to be this kind of second stage privatisation of the Royal Mail. Is that how you would style it?
Second stage, first stage. I mean, what we're heading towards possibly is privatisation. Ironically, I think it's like tripping back to the 80s. At the end of the day, you're selling something to the general public if it is a straightforward flotation like they did in the 80s in regards to the electricity, the gas, the water, and British Telecom. So they're going to sell something back that the British public already own.
Okay, so what is the crux of this new announcement?
I think the crux really that people need to recognise is that the increase in stamp prices is just the forerunner of privatisation and an increase in prices. I mean, you know, we need to have some history in regards to where we are at the moment. The post office and Royal Mail have been run down over many years with no investment, the pensions holiday by the company, and then deregulated, so competition came out when actually Royal Mail was not in a good position, and hey ho, there's a pension deficit.
Look, can you just explain what that pension holiday means? Because, you know, what is a pension holiday?
Well, effectively, the business took a decision many, many years ago, some 20 years ago now, to actually stop paying in the pension scheme because there was so much money in the scheme. So rather than increase the pensions for, you know, retirees, they decided that they weren't going to pay any more money into the scheme, and they just carried on with that. So effectively what's happened is that the pension scheme is now in deficit, but people need to recognise, although there's a deficit, the government are taking on the assets of the pension scheme, which is around the 25 billion mark, and they're going to use that to pay the deficit off. And the irony of that is that they'll use it to pay the deficit off, but they're going to take the pensions deficit on, so future governments, future taxpayers, will be liable for that pension scheme. So it's quite a crafty trick. And at the same time, then sell Royal Mail off, and whether that's a flotation on the stock market or it's going to be hedge funds that come in and asset strip Royal Mail and price increases will go up.
Well, I'm going to bring Martin Summers in here. I mean, the argument is, Martin, that the Royal Mail, as it stands, finds it very difficult to actually turn a profit. So it's only the private sector that can come in and make money at distributing our mail.
Well, that's ridiculous. I mean, basically, the Royal Mail has been salami sliced to pieces already. So it used to be a universal service which cross-subsidised things, didn't it? So you ran certain things at a profit, and then you used that profit to cross-subsidise the service part of it, like, I don't know, delivery of parcels on the Isle of Skye and so on. And people used to understand what that principle was. But, of course, once you start selling bits of it off, it all falls to pieces, step by step. And you'll end up with a situation where there is no real service. I mean, of course, even in the Tory shires, they get a bit annoyed when post offices are closed. And, you know, then they suddenly begin to realise what the implications of all this are.
Well, one of the things that I can remember from all of these privatisations in the past, right the way back to water privatisation, is that we were sold this idea that it was going to be cheaper. But quite clearly, this is definitely not, Kevin, is it? Because the stamp prices are going up, aren't they, by roughly 30, 40%.
I mean, what people have got to recognise, and I have been on your show to try and explain this, is that when the industry was deregulated, private companies come in and they cherry-picked business mail. Business bulk mail has always subsidised general stamp mail in the universal service. So once that they cherry-pick that particular aspect of the mail, then the profit margins decreased.
And these are the kind of letters that we have coming through our door, like bank statements, which have, rather than having a Royal Mail stamp on, have now got this kind of weird hexagonal or pentagram or something written on the letter, which is a symbol of some private firm that's actually picked up that mail.
Yeah, and also the Royal Mail have got to deliver the final mile, so they couldn't compete in the private marketplace for that mail, business mail. It's then dumped back into the delivery offices of downstream access at a very cheap price, because Royal Mail then got to deliver it. Now, my fear is, in the future, if it's privatised, obviously the cherry picking will obviously expand, and the universal service delivery to all the millions of addresses in the UK will obviously have to continue, hopefully, is that the taxpayer could possibly, maybe, pick that up. Because, you know, private companies are going to look at it and say, why should we contribute to the universal service? And although we've now moved from Postcom to Ofcom, who says that they're going to have a price element to making sure that the universal service is there, big business is about asset stripping, is about coming into Royal Mail, cherry picking the best bits, and yeah, the shires could be affected. Because if you're a company, what are you going to look at? You're going to look at Bristol in the southwest, Plymouth, Exeter and so forth, where it's easy to move mail around and there's a profit. Are you going to be interested in moving out to the rurals to make sure that you get that delivered? Possibly not.
How have the new companies that have come in since the first stage of this privatisation a few years ago, how have they been with regard to dealing with trade unions and with their workers?
Well, we've tried to make inroads into a number of private companies that have picked up that work, and it has to be said they're extremely hostile, and the terms and conditions that those people work under are nowhere near the terms of Royal Mail. And therein lies the problem in regards to the race to the bottom. I mean, I was listening to your interview with the NUT, and, you know, it's the oldest trick in the book. You create an internal marketplace, and then you effectively, like the academies and free schools. And there is an analogy. It may seem strange in regards to what's happening in Royal Mail. Internal marketplace, you force down prices, and then you force down terms and conditions. So it then becomes a race to the bottom. And what we're doing as a trade union is trying to recruit and organise those members in those companies. But they are anti-trade union. And their terms and conditions are nothing like what Royal Mail workers enjoy because of the trade union movement and its strength. So not only will the general public see price increases, we will have a battle on our hands to make sure that the terms and conditions within the industry as a whole doesn't decline.
But the thing is, at the moment, the Royal Mail apparently is not making money, and so we need, in order to maintain this six-day service, I mean, that is definitely, it seems, under threat. These price increases in stamps for ordinary sort of first-class, second-class stamps are necessary.
Well, we've got to a situation where they've had to increase because there's been no investment over many, many years, and it has to be said, it's not just this government, it's previous governments as well. That has led to a pensions deficit. It's led to no investment or hardly any investment within Royal Mail. Then you open the marketplace to private competitors. Then you end up in a situation where the only way that you're going to increase revenue is to increase prices. But as I said before, this is going to be the forerunner in regards to privatisation. This union will fight tooth and nail to make sure that doesn't happen, you know, not just for the universal service, but to make sure it's affordable to everybody, because there is another side to this. It's about, you know, people that cannot afford, especially in the times that we are at the moment, being able to post things. If there's price increases as well, that needs to be, there's a social element to this as well. And my fear is that when the market is completely open, and if we, you know, we're not successful in trying to make sure it's not privatised, that prices will continue. Anybody's only got to look at the telecoms market for that. At the end of the day, people made a lot of money through British Telecom shares, and they could do with the electricity, the water, and so forth. Is it improved the service? Prices have gone up. Quality of service, in my view, you know, companies don't want to talk about that.
Well, Kevin's bowled you a googly there, Martin, hasn't he? Because he's pointed out that actually it was a Labour government, and you're a Labour Party member, that started this whole process.
Well, I totally agree with him. And the CWU, you're not affiliated anymore?
We are. Yes.
You are affiliated. Well, I mean, the point is, I mean, I'm totally on. I mean, the current coalition are getting away with stuff because the stable door was opened by the previous lot. And I would advise trade unions collectively to start talking to the Labour Party leadership in a language they understand. If you don't start shaping up, we're going to take the money off you.
So,
and not peeling off one at a time, but so there's a whole trade union movement together. Yeah. This is what happened in New Zealand in the 80s when they were dealing with Roger Douglas and running the Treasury there, who was definitely a neoliberal loony. And the trade unions there, like their rugby, this pretty hardcore, and they just said, right, we're going to smash that, and they smashed it. But you can't do it by dribbling away one by one.
So, Kevin, this is the question, isn't it? Why is your union supporting the party that started this whole privatisation off?
It's an extremely difficult debate, and I can tell you that every annual conference, when we come to that particular issue about political affiliation and donations, it's not an easy environment. I mean, part of my role as a South West Regional Secretary, I'm the South West Political Officer, and part of my role is to liaise with the CLPs and the Labour Party. And it's difficult because at the end of the day, when you look at the grassroots of the party and good backbench MPs, they agree with the trade union movement, but it's making sure that you force that change through to the leadership, and we've got to do that collectively. There's an argument, do you, as some trade unions do, stand away from that and move away and have no influence with a political party, and the argument is from the membership is then actually you're saving money, or do you try and influence, and by doing that you've got to be inside the tent and not outside of it.
On that point, I spoke to somebody from the FBU National Executive in Bristol during their strike a few years ago, and he said, we've been disaffiliated from the Labour Party, but we're encouraging our members to join. It's a push-pull strategy. Yeah, I respected very well in Bradford the other day, but we can't count on that in other parts of the country. We've got to get this government out as quickly as possible, and the only viable alternative in the short run is the Labour Party, however flawed that is. And working class people are pragmatists. Yeah, they understand that you can't just have everything you want in one go.
Well, you say, Martin, we've got to get this government out, but actually the people out there, our listeners, voted them in.
Well, I don't think our listeners did, but somebody did. But I mean, they haven't really got a mandate. I mean, I would like to change the electoral system. You see, the left in New Zealand changed the electoral system at the same time, because they said, we can see what this game is. You know, they're very quick on the uptake. See what this game is. We've elected Labour to keep out the other side, the neoliberals and all the rest of it, but we're just going to get it anyway. Right, we're going to change the system then. Bang, crash, what? Like the New Zealand back row. And they did. They changed the system.
I think what's interesting, what we've seen, is that you would assume that with the coalition government, we've seen the political affiliations and the political officers within the CW decline over the years of the Labour government, and you would assume that with a coalition government that would come riding back. There would be enthusiasm all over the South West, and it has to be said, it's starting in pockets, but not coming back to the extent that we thought it would happen. And I think that's because there is some sort of feeling out there, well, okay, you've got a coalition government, they're pretty damn awful, and we know that, but actually, what is a new Labour government going to offer in regards to things like the post office? Now, as an example, at this year's conference, there will be a motion that ties, you know, a possible Labour government into withdrawing and reversing any decision on privatisation. So that motion will go down, and we will expect Labour MPs, CLPs, etc. to sign up to that if that goes through, which I think is probably a given. Because at the next election, if that's conference and that's the union's policy, there will be some sort of friction if, you know, prospective candidates say, I'm not signing up to that, when we're trying to reverse something which is about putting stuff back into the public sector.
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the root of the problem stems from the late 90s when trade union money went to the Labour Party centrally. And that made sense in a way, because of course in South Yorkshire they were spending money where they were going to win anyway. And so the argument was, let's pool the money centrally and win the marginal seats. This all presumes that we're working within the crappy electoral system that we've got. I mean, you need to think outside the box here, which is what New Zealand, you see, it's a young country with a dynamic Labour tradition, and they just sort of thought outside the box and changed it all. And of course, they then the Labour Party, when a final election was held under PR in New Zealand, having been forced by the Labour left, not by the Liberal Democrats, the right wing of the Labour Party were annihilated. They didn't get anybody elected.
But Martin, this isn't New Zealand.
What tends to happen, if you look at New Zealand, they gave women the vote in the 1880s and they started a welfare state in New Zealand in 1936. And there's usually Britain catches up with New Zealand with a time lag.
Yeah, this is kind
I think
of
this is a very important thing for us to assess in the Labour movement, because we've got to redeploy our forces.
I don't think many people would argue that there's some sort of political overhang within the left. You know, that the leadership of the Labour Party doesn't really represent most of the sort of left
in
this country. But I mean, the point really here is, how do you actually get the leadership to actually reflect the views of the people that they're supposed to be leading?
Well, we need a tightening the screws strategy, basically.
I think that sounds like torture.
Well, it could be torture for the wrong people. I mean, I think the Bradford West by-election result is a wake-up call to Labour leadership. And I saw Ed Miliband was in Birmingham this week going on about law and order and trying to get the squeezed middle to accept that... There's an awful lot of dead wood from the new Labour era still hanging over us, and we've just got to get them out, basically.
I think, really, you know, there is some difficulties there, and there is a battle going on. I mean, our union has tried over the last few months, and we've been successful about constituency development plans, where we've gone to the CLPs and the local Labour MPs and said, you sign up to our principles. And obviously join the CWU, and we will support you financially and also logistically. You'd still be surprised that some of the MPs, even unfortunately with some of the trade union background they've had in the past, that find it extremely difficult to sign up to things like that.
What's the pressure in the opposite direction then, Martin, against
these MPs?
They're
trying to climb the greasy pole inside the existing Labour Party, and if they go along with what you're doing, then they're obviously not good boys or girls, and they're going to get smacked.
Yeah, it was quite enlightening a couple of weeks ago to have the MP for Bristol East and the MP for Bristol West, that's Stephen Williams and Kerry McCarthy, in here discussing stuff. And then when we asked them about party funding, we had a vox pop, didn't we? Marina had done a vox pop for 3 or 4 minutes of members of the public talking about what they thought about the way parties were funded, and actually they didn't listen, neither of them in the studio listened to any of it, and by the time it came to the end of the question, they didn't really know what to say because they hadn't been listening. So do you think there is, you know, this wider problem in some more mainstream politics, Martin, that once they get elected every 4 years, at that point they sort of switch off from the public?
Well, I mean, inevitably, if you're in a system, you think that system's inevitable, don't you? And you've made your way within that setup, and you tend to think that that's the way the world works. Now, in actual fact, I think there's going to be a political transformation in this country in the near future, and I think we need to look to New Zealand in the 80s as the model, because it was actually the radicals of the left that forced that forced a complete transformation of the system. So under the new PR system, the what they called New Labour, Jim Anderton's party, swept the board. The right wing of the Labour Party was smashed. Greens and Maoris got their people elected, so a left-wing Labour Green Maori coalition came to power and renationalised the railways on day one. Now that is Southern Hemisphere rugby, and we've got to learn how to play it if we want to stay in the game.
Okay, Kevin, now what can you just give us an idea of the timeline of these latest proposals and what, you know, precisely is being proposed?
I mean, now the coalition government have got through the Queen's speech, the privatisation bill, what they're possibly looking at is in the autumn of 2013 and spring 2014 of then pushing that through to privatisation. Now, that sounds easier said than done, because at the end of the day, do you have a flotation on the stock market, which I think some of the right-wing Tories would want, because they would see that as the general public buying shares. I don't think they would necessarily be keen on perhaps a European postal operator coming in, because they would see it, you know, as their little England mentality would see that, why we don't want Royal Mail sold off to a European postal operator.
But that's happened with energy and railways and other things, hasn't it?
Well, it has. And the question's got to be, and I mean, we're on at the end of the day, we're in a coalition government. Now, given the timescales of 2013 into 2014 and the move that the Lib Dems would have to come out, you know, clear water 12 months before an election, is the timescales are very, very, very tight. So we're still relatively confident that we can carry on, even though the bill's been passed, a private anti-privatisation campaign, because we're in a coalition government with everything that that brings, and the timescales leading up to 2015, you know, you never know what's going to happen in that, within that last year and 18 months before an election. So everything is in place to privatise. It's whether they got the will to push that through. And given what we've been told about the timescales involved, it's very, very close to the election, and whether they'll have the bottle to do it. I hope they just don't rush it through. We don't want it at all, and they'll just sell it off to anybody just to push it through before a general election.
Are they going to get that far? There's about to be an economic crisis that's going to make what's happened so far look like a Sunday afternoon tea party.
Well, I mean,
the Liberals will have a nervous breakdown.
Surely, Martin, it's the economic crisis which is sort of forcing the hand here.
Well, it is. I mean, they're trying to get all this stuff through before the tsunami hits us, but the tsunami is going to hit us, and this is what worries me about the Labour leadership, is they are economically illiterate, and they think it's they're bumbling towards an election in 2014 where they've got to win Basildon. That's no good. This is World War III. They need to get their act together.
So how would a flotation, Kevin, actually affect your members, and how would it affect the public? What sort of changes would they see, do you think, in the kind of service we're getting, you know, from our posties?
Well, I mean, we're obviously concerned at the end of the day that we want to maintain the Royal Mail in the public sector, you know, the same as it has been in the 350 years, and also the taxpayer, you know, you and me and everybody else in the past has maintained that service. So we're in a position where governments have chosen to run that down. Okay, it's gone through the European Commission now that the government can take the pensions deficit on. So that will be taken on, and I suppose you've got to have faith in governments going forward that they suddenly won't turn around like they have done in the public sector and say, well, actually, the terms and the conditions that we agreed for your pension, actually, we've got to cut them now. So, you know, there's question marks around that. And also, at the end of the day, is it a flotation? Is it going to be our members sold a percentage of shares, so that's the carrot to dangle, where our members say, okay, oh, there's some shares, and then, you know, some years later they find out they haven't got a job. Because, you know, the cut to the chase, if it does get privatised, you will either have a hedge fund or private companies. Even if it's a flotation, there's usually a quick move by working class people that don't hang on to those shares, and the big money then comes in and swallows that up. And then what you're looking at is that once you've been, you know, you've made changes, there'll be cuts, there'll be offices that shut, there will be jobs that will go, because they've created the internal marketplace. And it's the oldest trick in the book. You know, we've seen it right across the utilities. We're seeing it in Royal Mail. And, you know, God, we're seeing it in the NHS, and we're seeing it in education. And it is frightening. It's really frightening for the people that work there, whether they're going to have jobs in the future. And at the end of the day, it's even about the jobs that are left. What type of jobs are they going to be? Are they going to be pushed to the bottom where the terms and conditions and pay are pretty awful? So the government can say, well, there's, you know, there's jobs in the industry still, but they're not very good jobs.
Also, these changes, I think I'm right in saying it's the 1st of May that the new postal charges are, Kevin, but we've heard, I mean, just looking at the Daily Mirror today, the Royal Mail is rationing stamps because customers are panic buying and stockpiling these first and second class stamps before this 30% price hike.
Well, I had a conversation today with a union official that covers post office and said, well, there's plenty in post offices and people don't need to worry. That said, I have spoken to some Unison officials today that work in schools that don't use meter post, that use stamps, and they said that they've been told that they can't purchase any more from post offices. So whatever they've got or they've ordered, they've actually put a date where they can't order any more. Because it was pretty obvious at the end of the day, when there's an increase in something, people go out and they buy it. We've seen that recently with the fuel panic, and that's happening with stamps. And at the end of the day, we shouldn't be in this position. We're in this position because government have not invested properly, and that's continued. They've opened the marketplace to deregulation, so they've let private, you know, private companies come in and cherry pick the work. And we're now in this situation in the post office with stamp increases, and the general public are paying the price for that effectively because of mismanagement by this government and previous governments.
So if you were in the position of Chief Executive of Royal Mail, Kevin, what sort of things would you do now in order to get it back on track?
Well, I mean, Chief Executive, I mean, we've got now Maura Green from Canada Post, and we know all about Maura Green because some of the comments and information we've had from how she handled Canada Post is not great, to be honest with you.
Well, what's that? What's that?
Come
well,
on. There was a McGregor figure.
Yeah, there was a drive to destroy the unions, drive down terms and conditions, etc. But you'd have to ask: is Maura Green and senior directors of Royal Mail worried about stamp increases and worried about privatisation? No, they wouldn't be, and the reason why: the previous directors, Alan Layton and Crozier, only hung around because they thought that it would be privatised and they would get share options. I probably think in 2 years' time, is Maura Green going to be around once it's privatised? No, I think she'll probably move on with lots of share options, the same as the directors. They are not against privatisation. They think it's the only avenue because the business financially is in difficulty. But are they going to be better off through privatisation than the postmen and women of this, on the streets delivering? Yes, they are.
But go back to the original question. If you were in the driving seat there, you know, you obviously know the business very well. What would you be up to?
I mean, I come from a completely political standing to the people that are running Royal Mail. At the end of the day, we've always pushed that the government keeps Royal Mail in a publicly owned company, and therefore they need to put the tax revenue in to make sure that it runs properly. Unfortunately, you know, my utopia of what Royal Mail should be like is not what the people or the government want for this country. It's a case of selling it off and splitting the business up. If there's price increases, so be it, and then the big business and shareholders will come in and they'll make loads and loads of money out of it. And unfortunately, as I said before, it's not just utilities, Royal Mail. It's going to happen in the good, you know, and trusted public services like the NHS and also education.
Ultimately, Martin, the Royal Mail traditionally has been a state run because the state wanted to actually be able to open letters. This is a long time ago. But what's the ultimate principle that behind these sort of nationalised infrastructure like the Royal Mail?
Well, this case has not been properly made for a generation. The idea that the private sector is always superior to the public sector is simply bunkum, frankly. Look at Statoil, which is the Norwegian state-owned oil company. One of the best managed companies in the world. It's owned by the Norwegian people. The trade unions have full recognition rights. The Piper Alpha platform would never have been built in the North Sea, because in the Norwegian sector, because the accommodation block would be completely far away from the wellhead. And they've made a fortune out of the North Sea, which has now gone into a sovereign wealth fund, which will pay for nursery schools and old people's homes in Norway well into the future. Is that inefficient? The answer is no. What we do is inefficient because we're run by a bunch of sharks and vultures.
Well, thanks, Martin, and thanks very much, Kevin Beater from the Communication Workers Union, for joining us on Drive Time this evening.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Take a junkie, and I inject it in your bloodstream. It's like a bad dream. Money's the fiend. Do you know what I mean?
Adventures of Stevie V there, 1990, and Dirty Cash. I'm rejoined now by Old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers to look at some of the world events. Martin, this week we had a big hoo-ha at the beginning of the week about this chap, Haroon Rashid Aswad. He's Abu Hamza's co-conspirator. It looks like he may escape extradition to the US on health grounds. But the whole thing is a little bit bizarre, isn't it? Because he's being extradited to the US for allegedly trying to set up a terrorist training camp there, whilst also having been most definitely involved in some way with the 7/7 London bombings, having met many of the alleged bombers beforehand. So how do they go about deciding that this court case should take place about something else in America rather than about the London bombings?
Well, they're just making it up as they go along. I mean, frankly, there's a number of people being held without habeas corpus in this country, including Haroon Rashid Aswad. And if they were actually put before the courts and the evidence against them was looked at, we would probably find that a lot of this stuff leads back into the security services, who are the real perpetrators of terrorism, which is why, of course, you have a non-habeas corpus place to dump people who've become embarrassed.
So you're saying there's no real terrorists then?
No, there are real terrorists and things get blown up. The question is, who are they?
This particular guy, Haroon Rashid Aswad, apparently he's mentally ill. He's been in Broadmoor. Mm. Well, what does that tell us about him? Apparently, you know, somebody mentally ill who was possibly involved as the mastermind of the 7/7 bombings, having met the four bombers beforehand, possibly giving them explosives.
He was on the phone to them, certainly, and he was named by the Metropolitan Police as the mastermind. But then John Loftus, the former FBI special prosecutor in the US, said, well, actually, he's been your agent for years, because the Americans have been trying to catch him. And every time he was arrested, and he was arrested in various places around the world, including in Africa and elsewhere, and then he was released because he was an MI6 double agent.
So why have we heard all about Hamza, the guy with the hook, because Abu Hamza, this week, and not about this his deputy, apparently?
Because Hamza, the guy with the hook, is another MI5 double agent, and a lot of what's going on here is people are being given a shadow play.
Are you really trying
terrorists.
To tell me that that Abu Hamza is working for MI6
or
MI5?
No, not necessarily. These guys are patsies. So what they are is they're expendable. And they get involved. I mean, it looks, you know, the people can be recruited to Al-Qaeda. Somebody approaches them and says, would you like to join Al-Qaeda? And they go, oh, yes, maybe. And then they join, and then they realise, actually, Al-Qaeda is actually something else than what they imagined. And this needs to be analysed properly, as it would have been analysed properly by the police service of Northern Ireland, for example, if they were looking into collusion between the RUC special branch and the loyalist paramilitaries. Now, that's the sort of thing people need to think about. If we're going to have wars on terrorism, then people need to understand what wars on terrorism are all about. It's about double agents, double crosses, and an awful lot of state manipulation.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Well, staying on the subject of terrorism, we've also had this attack in Toulouse a few weeks ago, and I was listening to France 24, which is an English language French satellite channel, and they have been talking about some of the revelations that have come out about Mohamed Merah, who it does seem the guy who was supposedly behind all these killings in Toulouse, he was working with the French intelligence services. So let's have a listen to that.
A former head of one of the main French intelligence agencies, a guy called Yves Bonnet, he said that Mohamed Merah was known as an informant to the Secret Service in France more than as an Islamist, so that he had had links with them in the past. He was an informant as regards jihadi movements. That seems to be the claim. Now, France Télévisions, they asked a terrorist expert on this, an intelligence agency expert, who said, look, it's perfectly possible that he would have been perhaps an informant. He had tried to work for the French army at one point, but he wasn't taken on. He had tried to work for the French Foreign Legion, so maybe he would have also been willing to help out the French Secret Service. Now, perhaps most interestingly, the Italian newspaper Il Foglio got their hands on some information. They say that Merah went to Afghanistan and Israel in September 2010 with French Secret Service assistance. Apparently, the aim of this, according to Il Foglio, was to gain the confidence of jihadis by showing them that he could get into Israel with a European passport in order to carry out attacks. So to build links with certain jihadi movements as a sort of an informant. So right. It's a very, very complex picture if this proves to be true. Worth pointing out that the head of the French Secret Service, Bernard Scorsini, has denied all of this, has said that he wasn't an informant. But what we are seeing certainly is a more complex picture emerging than perhaps we initially thought to be the case.
Well, I mean, this is again, I mean, I suspected about this case immediately that this was probably what was going on. I mean, I've said on this show before, people interested in the history of this kind of thing, they should just Google Gladio, G-L-A-D-I-O.
Or use your favourite search engine, not necessarily Google.
Because in actual fact, the Western Intelligence Service have got a track record of actually fomenting terrorism. Red Brigade's terrorism, fascist terrorism, and Islamist terrorism. And in Turkey, the Genocon network network is, they've got 200 top British top Turkish army military are on trial at the moment for fomenting all the terrorism in Turkey over the last 50 years, and of course they are our NATO allies and their chaps go to Sandhurst. Now put two and two together and you start to get the real picture. Most of the terrorism that's going on in the world, apart from with genuine movements like Hamas and Hezbollah, is actually orchestrated by the Western intelligence services. But you know what? We're about to catch them out big style.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Finally, a bit of news about Mitt Romney and Benjamin Netanyahu. They are old friends, apparently. They go back, mates, back to 1976. That's the Israeli Prime Minister and also the potential President of the United States, Mitt Romney, Martin.
Well, are we surprised? Not really. I mean, these kind of people have all these linkages. Look at the Werity Fox affair, where it looks like Werity was a Mossad agent, but he's wandering around in British secret meetings. Well, well, well.
Drive Time on BCFM, 5 till 7 on 93.2 FM.
Now joined by David Powell, just a little calmer from all the international terrorism, who's the economics campaigner at Friends of the Earth. Hi, David, and welcome to Drive Time.
Thanks, Tony.
Now, we've got something called the Green Investment Bank is on the horizon. I think it's this is a sort of baby of George Osborne's. Is this something that Friends of the Earth are looking forward to?
Oh, what you just said, I can't let that pass. One thing this definitely is not is a baby of George Osborne. So let's take a step back and see what's going on here. Now, if your glass was half full, you could say we've done brilliantly so far. Friends of the Earth started the campaign for the Green Investment Bank about 3 years ago now. We basically said we need to get huge amounts of money into renewables, into energy efficiency, into green investment, basically. But the private sector is not prepared to put its hands in its pocket because it doesn't think the government's serious about it, and the big investment banks aren't interested either. We've managed through 2 or 3 years of fighting, and I do mean fighting, managed to persuade the Treasury, this government, that they should do a Green Investment Bank, and now they've agreed they're going to do it. They take the credit for it, of course, but they've also put all sorts of constraints on it, saying, well, actually, yeah, you can have a green bank, but it can't do any borrowing or lending just yet because we have to sort the economy.
But hang on, that's just what banks do, isn't it?
Yeah, exactly. So in opposition, David Cameron said, will it be able to borrow and lend? He said, yes, it will. Of course it will. It's a bank. Of course it borrows and lends. Chris Hoon, who was the naughty energy secretary we had till recently, he said, well, you know, banks borrow and lend and ducks quack. And as far as I'm concerned, that's what a bank does. But in order to do that, that means the Treasury has to trust someone else with what it sees as its money, and it's not prepared to do that. So we've got a big fight on our hands now over the next couple of months to get this thing into law, actually working properly, actually able to issue what's called green bonds, i.e. borrowing and lending, so we can start making billions of pounds of investment.
Martin Summers, what is going on here? I mean, why is it that it seems that this present government wants to tie the hands of this bank, which could be the future, before it's even begun?
I think the problem is that if you've got a properly organised, as essentially public sector banking structure going on, the private sector just doesn't compete, and it really is one or the
other. So you're saying that the floodgates could open and everyone That's will be putting their money into it. The green investment
That's
bank?
That's why they're worried about it. I mean, we could use RBS, for example, as a national investment bank, not just for green things. Yeah. But of course, once you've got a structure like that in place, then the private sector basically can't keep up. And really, ultimately, we're going to have a nationalised banking system, in my view. And I think what you've done with pushing the Green Investment Bank as far as you've pushed it is very good. I mean, it's a seed of something good, isn't it? But it's at the moment, they're just trying to smother it, basically, and stop it going anywhere.
I mean, what we've got so far is fantastic. So we've got a commitment to do a green bank, and it's being given about £3 billion of public money to start off. You know, it's not useless. It's not a completely, duck
of
a bank.
Marginal, though, isn't
but
it?
What it isn't is it doesn't have the freedom. George Osborne would have to let it out of its grip. He'd have to let it go and borrow and lend. And of course, ultimately, all of that could come back to haunt him if all that borrowing and lending goes wrong. We know what the number one narrative is in the country. It's austerity. It's cut the deficit. It's cut the debt. I'm sure Martin will dress it up however he wants in terms of the reasons for doing that, a lot of which I would agree with. But that comes first. And kickstarting the green economy. And that's where the future is, Low carbon goods and services is a $3 trillion global market for this stuff. But you've got to spend your money to do it. And that's where the government's falling short at the moment.
Now, you've pointed out to me this article this week saying that a company in Tyne and Wear is to create up to 1,000 new jobs with a grant of £640,000 from the government. So this seems to be a sort of thing that the Green Investment Bank might be able to do itself in the future.
Yeah, well, this is today's news, Tony. This is fantastic stuff, actually. The one thing the government can't really be criticised for is helping the wind industry get off the ground. So we've got, we're in Ireland surrounded by some fairly miserable weather, a lot of which actually is making its way inland this evening by the looks of it. We need to be harnessing that, and the government gets that, and it's given £640,000 to a particular bit of the wind industry. This company makes the concrete bases that big offshore wind turbines sit on. And it's exactly the sort of thing that a green investment bank could be doing. We don't have that yet, so this is the sort of thing that government's doing well at the moment, but it's a drop in the ocean, literally and naturally.
Okay, so do you think, what's your feeling about this green investment bank? Is it going to work out? Do you think you're going to be able to put the screws onto the government to actually let it sort of spread its wings and do its job?
Well, there's a huge amount of pressure for it. So Labour want it to be a bank that can borrow and lend. The investment community do as well. There's a thing called the UK Sustainable Investment Fund that represents something like £500 billion worth. They say, look, let this thing fly. All the MPs want it. Anyone who actually sits down and looks at it says exactly what you said to me, 10 minutes ago. Isn't that what a bank's supposed to do? Well, yeah, it is what a bank's supposed to do. So there will be a lot of pressure over the next couple of months. If we don't succeed in getting it exactly right this time, then the important thing is to make sure it's not set into stone in the wrong way at the moment, so we can go back and get it borrowing and lending pretty quickly.
Well, David Powell, economics campaigner at Friends of the Earth, thanks very much for joining us. And of course, if you want to help put pressure on to get this green investment bank going, Friends of the Earth is at www.foe.org.uk.
I think that's right, or
.co.uk. Yeah. So you're like a corporation rather than an organisation. Anyway, you'll certainly find them out there. Thanks very much for joining us this evening, David. Well, that's all the serious talk out of the way this evening, because Friday night is music night. 2 hours live with Pat Hart and the Fresh Blood Party crew, followed by the UFO show. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Conservative MP for Filton and Bradley Stoke, Jack Lopresti. Also to former SAS soldier Ben Griffin, to Kevin Beezer from the Communication Workers Union, and there you just heard from Dave Powell from Southwest Friends of the Earth. Also, to old Labour Oxford economist Martin Summers. Next week, we take a close look at changes to the police and education. Every BCFM show is available online. Just go to bcfm.org.uk, or even easier, thisweek.org.uk takes you straight to this show and to our archives. A podcast of this show is online roughly 10 minutes or so. Sometimes it seems to take about 24 hours, but anyway, after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. And music this week is from 1992, Sabrina Johnson with Peace.
It's better.